Morally and spiritually, our nation is in decline. What once was considered immoral by the vast majority of Americans is now deemed as moral behavior. Years ago, sexual perversion, adultery, pornography, couples cohabiting before marriage, and homosexuality were considered by the majority as immoral and thus unacceptable. But today, adultery, extramarital affairs, premarital sex is considered the norm. After all, everybody is doing it, and anything is okay as long as it's between two consenting adults. Homosexuality is now considered an alternative lifestyle. With the recent Supreme Court ruling that makes homosexual marriages legal in all 50 states, the advocates of gay rights have succeeded in changing the definition of marriage to include same-sex marriages. People living today live in openly gay relationships, and that lifestyle is being introduced to our children and grandchildren through health and parenting education. You know, there was a time in our country when life was sacred, and doctors would do whatever they could to save lives. But today there's more compassion for abused animals and endangered species than for hundreds of thousands of babies murdered each year through abortion. Animal rights groups are lobbying against the use of cats and other animals for research, and yet at the same time, human tissue and parts from aborted babies are being sold for research and development. One time, nearly everyone had some religious background or upbringing. Most had some knowledge, be it small, about Christ. Most had some church affiliation, even if they only attended on Christmas or Easter or at weddings and funerals. But today we have the first pagan generation in America, children and teens with no spiritual background at all, who do not even have a clue as to who Jesus is, except as a name of profanity. We're witnessing a nation going after the occult and after the supernatural powers of darkness. Our nation is in spiritual, moral decline. We're fast becoming a post-Christian nation. Now, what is even alarming, more alarming than that, is that introduction that I just gave, I wrote 35 years ago for a sermon. And I think, except I updated a little bit along the way, but I don't think we've made any progress. We've gone the other direction the last 35 years. You know, centuries ago, it was to a stark spiritual world similar to ours that Jesus Christ came and announced that he said, "I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. I am the light of the world." As the light of the world, Jesus Christ is the personal final revelation of God to man. As the light of the world, Jesus Christ expresses the holiness of God and exposes the sinfulness of man. As the light of the world, Jesus Christ opens spiritually blinded eyes and blinds those who are spiritually proud. As the light of the world, Jesus Christ leads us from the realm of spiritual darkness to the realm of spiritual light, and in that process, he transforms our lives. He invites us to follow him as he is the light of the world, to follow him by first of all believing in the light, believing the truth claims that he makes concerning himself, and trusting in him for our salvation from sin and a new life that follows. To follow him means simply just that. We follow Jesus. We follow Jesus. We place ourselves under his leadership. And when we do so, a fundamental transformation takes place to where we live and operate. We no longer walk or live in the realm of darkness, but we have been transferred to the realm of light. We have the light of life. That is, a fundamental transformation has taken place as to who we are. As Paul says in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 8, "For you were once darkness, but now light in the Lord." We were once darkness, but we're now light. We are now sons of light. In this way, Jesus says of us, "You are the light of the world." We derive our light from him. We reflect, are to reflect his light to this world. Now, my friends, if we have the potential, I raised this last time we were together, if we have the potential of being a 1,000-watt light bulb, why is it that we only produce 10 or 15 watts? Why are we such dim bulbs? What? Dimwits. How can we, and you and I, become God's light bearers? How can we practically live as children of light? What can we do to increase our spiritual lumens? Well, Paul in Ephesians chapter 5 answers these questions and shows us how we can be effective light bearers. Follow along as I begin reading at verse 7 of Ephesians chapter 5. He says, "Therefore, do not be partakers with them, for you were once darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light. For the fruit of the Spirit is in all goodness, righteousness, and truth, finding out what is acceptable to the Lord. And have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather expose them, for it's shameful even to speak of those things which are done by them in secret. But all things that are exposed are made manifest by the light, for whatever makes manifest is light. Therefore, he says, awake you who sleep, arise from the dead, and Christ will give you light." Now, Paul begins here by saying that that if we want to be lights in this world, we must not be partakers with them. We have to be separate from the world. In fact, he says here in verse 7, "Therefore, do not be partakers with them." Now, with who? With who is the question? Well, look back at verse 3 of chapter 5. He says, "But fornication and all uncleanness or covetousness, let it not even be named among you as is fitting for saints, neither filthiness nor foolish talking nor coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather giving of thanks. For this you know, that no fornicator, unclean person, or covetous man who is an idolater has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things, the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Therefore, do not be partakers with them." Now, he lists a whole lot of things here. You know, our world today spells love, L-U-S-T. Whatever God has established, Satan has counterfeited. Where God establishes true love, Satan produces counterfeit love. The world's love is lustful and self-indulgent. It loves because the object of love is attractive, enjoyable, pleasant, satisfying, appreciative. Loves in return produces the right kinds of feelings, turns you on, and is likely to repay in some way. The world's perverted love is always based on the other person fulfilling one's own needs and desires and meeting one's own expectations. It's making the other person happy. It's not what one can give, but what one can get. In our culture, sex has been equated with love. The act of intimacy is called in our culture today making love. Now, sex by itself is not sinful. God created it. God created it to be enjoyed by a man and a woman in the security and privacy of a marriage relationship. It is one of the highest expressions of committed love. It's a visual aid of the essence of marriage as two become one flesh. It is also an aid and an illustration of the relationship between Christ and the church. The writer of Hebrews says in Hebrews 13, verse 4, marriage is honorable among all, and the bed undefiled, but fornicators and adulterers God will judge. Man has taken what God has created to be something beautiful in the boundaries when it's celebrated between one man and one woman bound together in a covenant marriage relationship for life, and he has perverted it. Man has perverted it by a number of different ways. First of all, he's perverted it by his works. Look at verse 3. He says, but fornication and all uncleanness or covetousness, let it not be even named among you as it fitting for saints. There are three words here, three works. The first is fornication. It says, but fornication. Fornication is actually the Greek word porneia, from which we get our words pornography. Pornography is actually two Greek words, porneia and graphe, and combined together into our English word. And it refers to all illicit sexual sins, premarital, extramarital affairs, incestuous relationships, homosexualities. All of these fall under the category of porneia or fornication. Now, the opposite of porneia is a Greek word, enkratia, which refers to self-control, especially in the area of sex. Paul writes this in 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 3. He says, for this is the will of God, your sanctification, that you should abstain from sexual immorality, and that each of you should know how to possess his own vessel in sanctification and in honor, not in passion of lust like the Gentiles who do not know God. This is a description of self-control in this area. We're to learn how to control our own bodies, our own passions, our own hormones in a way that is holy and honorable. And not to be like the world that do not know God and just allow there to be ruled by their hormones and whatever their feelings might be. And so we're to avoid fornication. He says another one here is uncleanness. All uncleanness. This is a more general term than porneia and refers to anything that is dirty or unclean. It refers to immoral thoughts, passions, ideas, fantasies, and every form of sexual corruption. Now, all of these acts of sexual immorality all stem from the third, which is listed here, and that is covetousness. Every form of sexual immorality is an expression of the self-will, self-gratification, and self-centeredness of greed. It is by nature contrary to love, which is self-giving. When tempted to step out on a mate, it's not because of love for the other person. It's out of a desire for self-gratification. When a man tells a woman, you know, if you love me, you'll go to bed with me, it's not biblical love which is prompting him, but covetousness. He wants something which should only be given to her husband. Now, our world is full of people who have been used and abused by others for their own sexual gratifications. Unsaved men and women, they boast about their sexual partners. Some of them boast about how many they have bedded over the years. And many today are foregoing marriage. They just move in together, try it before you buy it. It's an idea today. Some have no intentions of ever buying unless they're somehow trapped into marriage. That's the morality of the world surrounding us. That's the world in which we live. But you know, the intimacy of marriage has not only been perverted by works, but also by perverted words. Look at verse 4 of chapter 5. He says, neither filthiness, nor foolish talking, nor coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather giving of thanks. Three words here. Filthiness. That's talk, which is degrading and degrading and disgraceful. In the parallel passage in Colossians 3, verse 8, Paul says, but now you yourselves are to be put off all these anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy language out of your mouth. Filthy language. He also talks here about foolish talking. That is actually one word in the ancient text, and it's used here only in the New Testament. It's a compound word, lego, which means to speak, and moros, which means dull, stupid, idiotic. It's where our word moron comes from, the Greek word moros. In other words, it's stupid talk. Stupid talk in which befits someone who is intellectually deficient. It's the kind of talk that you would expect to come out of the mouth of a fool or out of the mouth of a drunk. It's what we would consider gutter talk. And then the third is jesting. That is raunchy humor. It's the idea of turning something which has been said or done, no matter how innocent it is, into something which is obscene or suggestive. The dirty jokes, the raunchy humor. All you need to do is listen for 5 minutes to almost any of the stand-up comics that are on TV, and you'll hear sexual innuendos, filthy talk, jesting. Some kind of perversion. Some are so perverted that they can take any comment, even something innocent, and turn it into something sexual. I'm reminded of Paul's assessment in Titus chapter 1, verse 15, when he says to the pure, all things are pure, but to those who are defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure. But even their minds and consciences are defiled. They can make a mockery out of anything. Nothing is sacred. Anything can be made fun of, even sexualized, and they do it without a tinge of conscience. Now note what Paul says here in verse 3. He says, but fornication and all uncleanness or covetousness, let it not even be named among you as it's fitting for saints. Let it not even be named among you. The NIV translates this, let there not even be a hint of sexual immorality or any kind of impurity or covetousness among you. This perverted kind of love, rather lust, with its perverted works and words, is really out of place for you and I. Inappropriate behavior for believers. We're to abstain completely from every form of this perverted kind of love. Why? Well, it says simply here in Ephesians 5, verse 3, it's not fitting for saints. It's not saintly. It doesn't fit the lifestyle of one who claims to be born again by the Spirit of God, one who's been set apart by God from sin. Peter writes this, he says in 1 Peter 2, verse 11, behold, beloved, I beg you as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul, having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may by your good works which they observe glorify God in the day of visitation. We are to abstain from fleshly lusts. They war against our souls. Because we're to have our conduct honorable among the Gentiles. They might speak against us now, but one day they'll have to say, you know, he lived the life in front of me. We're not to be partakers with them. Paul warns us in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, he says, do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers, for what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness, and what communion has light with darkness? Therefore come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord. Many times people take that verse as against a believer and an unbeliever getting married. It's not in that context at all. It's not in the context of marriage. But it's the idea of us being different from the world around us. Now, may I say to you, separation from the world does not mean isolation. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 5, verse 9, I wrote to you in my epistle not to keep company with sexually immoral people, yet I certainly did not mean with the sexually immoral people of this world, or with the covetous or extortioners or idolaters. Since then, you would need to go out of the world. In other words, we're not to become isolationists. God has not called us to sell our belongings, buy property somewhere in the middle of nowhere, out in the tule bushes, and build a Christian commune, grow our own vegetables, raise our own cattle for meat, and live in complete isolation from the world surrounding us. He has called us to be in the world, but not of the world. To be in the world, but the world is not to be in us. That's the distinction. You know, perhaps one of the reasons our light bulbs are so dim is that the world sees very little difference between us and them. Our words, our works, the lifestyle we live, the choices we make, they're just like the people surrounding us. They see no difference in us. Many Christians see nothing wrong with living together unmarried. After all, everybody else is doing. Many Christians enjoy the same entertainment as the world. Their priorities are the same as those around them. The world might see us as religious because we go to church, but they fail to see the relationship with Christ that makes the difference in our lives and has transformed our lives so that we no longer live like them, we do not speak like them, we do not love what they love. See, it's the world in us that causes the light bulb to dim. You know, by definition, an influence must be different from that which is seeking to influence. As Christians, therefore, we must be different from the world we are called to influence. We cannot influence the world, for God is worldly ourselves. We cannot give light to the world if we revert to places and ways of darkness ourselves. If we are to be effective light bearers, we have to be distinct from the surrounding world around us. Now, may I say secondly this morning that we become light bearers as we develop light-like character qualities. Look at verse 8 of chapter 5. He says here, for you were once darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light, for the fruit of the Spirit is in all goodness, righteousness, and truth, finding out what is acceptable to the Lord. See, you see, separation. Separation is never one direction. It is always two, bidirectional. It is separation from the world so that we can be separate unto God. And our focus needs to be on being separate unto God, that is, on developing personal holiness. We need to take up the challenge that Peter puts out in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 15, where he says, but as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct, because it is written, be holy, for I am holy. The challenge for you and I, and the focus for you and I, is to develop light-like qualities, character qualities. Separation from the world without the corresponding development of personal holiness produces external religious legalism and internal self-righteous hypocrisy. Separation from the world without the corresponding development within us of personal holiness produces an external religious legalism and internal self-righteous hypocrisy. The case in point would be the Pharisees of Jesus' day. In Jesus' day, there were two main religious parties in Judaism. The Sadducees, they were the liberals because they didn't believe in the resurrection nor in the existence of angels, and they were loose in their interpretation of Scripture and also in their conduct. They tried to fit into the world surrounding them. At the other extreme were the Pharisees, who were the conservatives. And they held to a high view of Scripture, believed in the resurrection from the dead, and in a strict interpretation of the law. They were also the separatists in Jesus' day. They didn't associate with those who were not part of their group. Certainly, they would never think of eating with the tax collector or with a sinners. They lived according to the very strict and narrow interpretation of the law. They ate only kosher foods, those included in the list in Leviticus chapter 11. They offered the sacrifices for cleansing, for uncleanness as prescribed in Leviticus 12. They would never think of touching a leper, for that would violate God's command for a holy people in Leviticus 13 and 14. They had little to do with the Gentiles, with the pagans. You could spot a Pharisee a mile away because of the way that they dressed. They would never think of going to the mall on the Sabbath day. They were so afraid of violating one of the commands of God that they developed their own laws, secondary laws based on the Ten Commandments, and then substituted their own laws for God's, and thus became legalists. They prescribed how far one could walk on the Sabbath day without breaking the Sabbath, how much ink one could have in their pen. They had rules upon rules upon rules, down to the very tithing of their herbs and spices. They majored on separating from the world surrounding them, on being distinct and being different. But what they failed to do is they failed to develop the corresponding internal holiness. To them, Jesus said, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you cleanse the outside of the cup and the dish, but inside they are full of extortion and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisees, first cleanse the inside of the cup and dish, then the outside of them may also be clean too." Jesus says to them, "You focus in the wrong place. You're focusing on the outside and what people see, your appearance. You appear to be separate from the world, to be distinct, to be different, but inside, you're full of all kinds of sin, all kinds of self-indulgence. You're not developing a heart of holiness. You appear to be righteous on the outside. Concentrate on the internal, for God changes us from the inside out. God changes us from the inside out. Cleanse the inside and the outside will be clean also." Jesus isn't finished. He delivers another zinger in here. Matthew 23, 27. He says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. For you are like whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, but are full of dead man's bones and uncleanness. Even so, you also outwardly appear righteous to men, but inside you're full of hypocrisy and lawlessness." Jesus didn't have kind words for them, did he? Doesn't have kind words for hypocrites. Doesn't have kind words for hypocrites. He says, "You mean you're beautiful on the outside, you're like whitewashed tombs. But boy, you're a putrid on the inside." See, they appear to be righteous, inside full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. You see, the Pharisees thought that they were so much better than everybody else, that they lived a couple notches above the world surrounding them. They were constantly comparing themselves with the lowlife and sinners. When they did their religious acts, they made sure that others took notice of it. They prayed publicly on busy street corners. When they gave alms to the poor, they made sure others would see just how much they gave. When they fasted, you could tell that they had not missed a meal by the look on their face or by the groan in their voice. To the person looking on, they looked so pious, so religious, but they failed to develop internal holiness. May I say to you, my friends, it's very easy for us to conform to outward religious legalistic standards and to think that one is separate from the world surrounding them. Personal holiness is measured by what one does not do to them. They don't go eating places. Some don't go to eating places that sell alcohol. They don't go to movie theaters or watch TV. They don't work on Sundays. They don't go to sporting events or concerts. They don't drink, smoke, or chew, or go with girls who do. They also measure their personal holiness by what they do, how they measure up to their own list. They're in church every time the church doors are open. They never miss a Sunday. They do give a tenth of their finances to the church. They do help out occasionally, are involved in, to some degree, in the life of the church. They live up to their external standards of a good Christian. But unless they're developing internal light-like qualities, unless they are developing internal personal holiness, they end up being hypocrites. They look good on the outside, but inside full of garbage. They are chocolate-covered manure. And the world sees straight through the candy coating on the outside to see the hypocrisy within. Now, if we're to be like God's light bearers in this world, we must concentrate on developing light-like character qualities, personal internal holiness. We need to walk as children of light. But what is involved in developing this light-like quality? I think I'm going to stop there this morning. Now, developing this light-like qualities, certainly one of the things we need to do is make sure that there's no sin in our lives that we haven't confessed and forsaken. You know, sin kind of dirties us so that others can't see Christ in us. I was reminded of that the other day when I was coming home from Wilmington and the headlight on my car burned out and I couldn't see. It was on that dark night. It was snowing. They had put salt on the road, and so you had all that water spray coming up onto the windshield. And so I turned down and had fog lights on the RAV, and I turned them on. That helped some to at least see the side of the road so I wouldn't run off of it. But I got home and put new bulbs in. The next day we were coming home again. It was kind of dark and so on. I said, boy, it's really not. I just put new bulbs in. They're really not that bright. I must have got the wrong bulbs or something. Then I got home and I looked. I got out of my car and I looked, and here the road spray from all that salt and stuff had coated the outside of my lens on my headlight. Wasn't the bulbs weren't bad, it was that the lens was dirty so that the light could not shine through. And that's what happens to us when our lives become dirty. We don't deal with sin that we know that's there, and in a sense we develop then the externals. We can put on the act instead of dealing with the sin, getting rid of that, so that we can be a clean vessel that God can use and God can shine through us. Yeah, what is the one thing that unsaved people say about us in church? What is about the church? Church is what? Full of hypocrites. Hypocrites. See, God doesn't demand of us, and we're going to see that next time when we continue this. God doesn't demand of us to be perfect, but to be authentic. To be authentic Christians. To live out our faith. Yes, I think we will all probably readily agree here that we haven't arrived yet. None of us have. God's in process of developing us as to believers. We need to deal with the sin up front and upright and forsake it, go on, and allow the light of God to shine through us and not just pass over it and become put on a facade on the outside. But so that it come from the inside. So people would know that we genuinely know and we genuinely love God and are serving Him. And so that's the challenge I want to leave with us today, not to become Pharisees. As we get back into Galatians, we're going to see God hasn't called us to that kind of a legalistic lifestyle. He's called us to live in freedom and develop a true, genuine heart-produced holiness of life that comes from the Spirit of God.